to call this meeting to order. And so I will do that. Good morning. Call the meeting to order. And this meeting will be held in accordance with House Rule 10.01, which is posted online. And for most people, they've been through that a time or two with other committee meetings. We do know, based on how this is tracked, that we have people's phone numbers in the system, and we know that we are at a quorum. So we can go ahead with our activity. And right now, we do have approval of minutes as the first thing up. So Representative Brand, the motion on adoption from the last meeting.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I move adoption of the minutes dated March 12, 2020.
Thank you. So the minutes were posted online and sent to you. Any comments or questions? And unless I hear any, I don't hear anybody jumping in on that. So seeing no comments or hearing no comments, Representative Brand's motion is before us. We've been advised we don't need a roll call for minutes, so we're just going to do a voice vote. So if you unmute your phone, and all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed say nay. I hear none, so motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Okay, and so we'll move on from there. We have two bills on the agenda. And we will also be hearing from Commissioner Peterson and Dr. Thompson for their COVID-19 update. But just so you know, this is in, obviously, for agriculture, unprecedented times for everybody and very challenging for our constituents, our farmers and small businesses, large businesses, packing plants, pork producers, ethanol plants, I mean, across the board, across the state, we've had just many, many struggles. And so we know that people feel the stress and appreciate that people are struggling in a number of ways. We've been working behind the scenes trying to make sure that we can continue to provide support to our farmers, and thank you to those that have assisted in that effort. In the past, we were able to do the Second Harvest Heartland funding. We did the Farmer Lender Mediation Extension early on when we did the RFA loan program. We've been doing a number of things, and I appreciate everybody's support to move in support of agriculture. And obviously, this is a little bit different, just doing things online or by phone. So we anticipate there could be some glitches, but we are going to continue to do the work as we best can. And the other things that we knew that we had before us was to do an ag policy bill and an ag finance bill. And what we're going to do, we did have, we had introduced the governor's pre-COVID-19 supplemental finance bill, and that is what we want to be able to kind of hear today, so just have an informational hearing on that. We anticipate that on Thursday we'll actually be doing a DE to that bill and have our own version of a supplemental ag finance bill, but today we wanted to give the opportunity to the governor's staff and to the Department of Ag staff to be able to walk us through that. So we have with us Peter Chessis from MDA, and he's going to do a walkthrough, a fairly brief walkthrough. We have I think Paul Zuganen is probably online, and maybe others online as well. So I just want to turn it over to Peter and have him get started. At the end, we'll have a little bit of opportunity for questions if people have questions about the governor's proposal. So, Mr. Chessis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Peter Chessis, Director of Government Affairs at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Madam Chair, would you like me to start with the supplemental, the finance bill?
Yes, please. So what we're going to do now is the informational hearing on the language provisions contained in House File 4538. Which is the governor's supplemental ag finance bill. So, yes, if you could do that. We introduced it on 4/14/2020, and it was kind of right before we were shut down, so we didn't we didn't have the opportunity to actually hear it at that point. And so that's what we're doing now, is to be able to hear it. Certainly budget priorities, we have different considerations now, but what we're just doing today is kind of a little bit of a walkthrough. We are not officially acting on this today, but it is House File 4538. So you can go ahead and continue, Mr. Chestnut.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I believe members will be familiar with a number of the provisions in here already. There's an ask for additional money for our rural mental health program, which would include additional Safe Talk programs, some further outreach for the outreach to agricultural communities for, again, suicide prevention, develop new curriculum for adolescents, farm adolescents who are adjusting and coping with stress. There would be a production of a video for folks to use to learn how to put on Safe Talk presentations. If there are any questions on that, I could be happy to answer them. But I believe the committee has heard about that already. There's also additional money for our farm safety initiatives. That was, I believe, also in front of the committee briefly. That would just relaunch the tractor rollover protection grant program and use that program to create a similar cost share program for grain bin safety equipment, which I know the committee has heard a lot about earlier in the session. There'd also be additional farm safety outreach as part of that campaign, just to highlight tractor safety, grain bin safety, and distribution of educational materials as it as they apply to both of those. And then I believe new since the last time we met in person would be the assistance to farmers who have lost markets based on COVID-19. And that would be for, producers who had contracts with schools or other farmers market type situations in which those contracts were lost because of COVID. And on the line, I have our Division Director of Ag Marketing, Paul Huguenin, who can briefly talk about what an assistance program like that would look like. Are you there, Paul?
I am. Madam Chair, members, my name is Paul Huguenin, Director of Ag Marketing and Development. Just a quick word on that is, as Mr. Chestnut mentioned, it would be for people who have lost markets in things like farm to school, but also in more traditional restaurant settings and other food service settings. One of the strategies for some of those companies is to try to diversify their markets, and one of the ways to do that is there are a number of online platforms that allow them to reach retail markets or direct-to-consumer markets so that they can continue to sell product and make up at least part of the gap that they're losing. And so the dollars that we're asking for there would be money that we could do cost share programs with these food processors around Minnesota. Some of them are farmers who are marketing their own value-added products. Others, processors who are taking raw products and selling it into various markets. And so we would help them develop more diversified markets, try to capture as much revenue as possible. Some of that could be providing technical assistance in terms of, how one goes about doing that. And we've seen models around the country like that. For those who have perishable products, one of the other strategies is to help, they may simply need to buy time with additional cold storage until additional markets open up. So that's a super short introduction to what we would do to try to help producers and processors with value-added products make up for the loss of farm to school and other food service markets.
Thank you, Mr. Huguenin. Okay, back to Mr. Chesis.
Yes, Madam Chair, I believe in terms of the governor's request, that is all we have in there.
Okay.
Would you like me to go on to Article 2, to the wholesale produce
language? Hold on a minute. We're just going to take any questions here for what you had. And I know Representative Lewis, did you have a question to this issue?
Nope, I didn't. I must have. I just sent a test message in, but I don't have a question.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. I'm glad that you're checking things out. That's good. And I think what we will do is then, if there anybody, I don't have anybody that's listed that may have a question on what Mr. Chesis went through.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
This is Representative Anderson. I'm not real technical,
sure. By
not able to punch in, but could I ask Mr. Jessup a question on what he just mentioned about the lost markets because of
the
COVID?
Yes, you may. Yes, you may. Go ahead, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give us any idea of the scope of this type of business? How large an activity is this? And just to give us some idea of how many market-type activities we have of this direct selling to whether farmers markets or schools. Do you have any idea of the scope of this type of marketing?
Mr. Chesis.
Madam Chair, members, I will call on my colleague Paul Huguenin to see if he has an idea of the scope of that.
Mr. Huguenin.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, so it's difficult to quantify in terms of numbers. I can give you a little anecdotal evidence, if you will. We've got a person in my division who has kind of offered herself up to work with the Grocers Association, and so she has encouraged farmers who were selling to farm to school and have lost markets through that already. And I know that she has, I think it's at least 30 different farmers contact her about that. And so that's one very specific entity there. But that doesn't get at the number of processors, because that group who contacted her are primarily growing, you know, produce and other things that they're selling to schools. In all honesty, I don't have an ability to give you a number of like food processors in Minnesota who've lost those markets, but it's all I can say is it's significant, and each company kind of has a different marketing mix, and so for some that is the dominant market they have, and for others it's one piece of it. And our strategy would be to help those who have that as a big part of their business redirect and create new additional markets that are not food service related.
Representative Anderson.
No, thank you for that answer. Appreciate it.
Chair Poppy.
Yes.
This is Representative Hamilton. Can I be recognized?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. So just a point of clarification. Now, this is very, very narrow in scope, correct? I mean, this does not cover the farmers that are putting down thousands of birds or pigs or dumping thousands of gallons of milk, correct? I mean, this is, again, just very narrow in scope. Is that accurate?
Members, yes, that is correct. The piece that I was talking about is very narrow in scope, and it's targeted at people who are marketing value-added products, either the processors themselves or a farmer who has their own, you know, branded product. But you're absolutely correct, Representative Hannafin.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Yes. Any other questions? Anyone else who seeks to be recognized to ask a question? I'm not getting any other notice from Carl about that. So thank you, Mr. Chesis, and thank you, Mr. Huguenin. We are going to walk through the DE amendment to House File 4285 next. Just a little bit of conversation about that. We heard a number of bills all session, through March, through when we could. So the DE reflects the main substance of the House File 4285, which is the MDA policy bill, as well as other provisions from bills we heard and issues that we identified throughout the last couple of months. So we did post this on the website at 8:55 this morning, and we certainly had hoped to get it out sooner, but obviously COVID activity has taken over, and many people have a number of pressing issues that we're dealing with in the House and Senate. So time was not necessarily on our side, but we really wanted to be able to bring this forward. We have about a 99% agreement with the Senate about the language in these provisions in the DE. We don't have 100% agreement, but both the House and Senate Ag committees are working toward getting to that point. And I know that the Senate is meeting today, the Senate Ag Policy Committee is meeting today too. So we wanted to be able to get us to a point of with a vast majority of agreement to be able to present the DE today. We are not voting on it today. We will be able to hear what is in the bill. We'll have Mr. Sullivan and Mr. Savory go through the bill, and that we will ask for any public testimony by written testimony if people want to do that before noon tomorrow. They can send us some written testimony so we can provide that to the committee members. And we also will take any amendments to the DE. Those will be due by 5 p.m. tomorrow. So we intend to meet on Thursday and pass the DE and with any amendments to be able to pass that out on Thursday. So no action taken today. Votes on the DE and the amendments to the DE will occur on Thursday, and it will then be moved to Ways and Means and from there to the floor. So, but Mr. Chessis was talking about other, the finance, supplemental finance. Now he's going to switch gears and talk about the ag policy, DE. And he will start us off because it's through the Department of Ag that some of these things are related to. So we're just going to give him a couple of minutes to talk about Article 1. And I know that we have at least one question on that. So I'm going to first move that House File 4285. I'll just move that we bring that before us. We aren't going to be opening or we're not going to be voting on anything, but we will just move it to have it before us. And hopefully people have access to a computer to be able to see the DE. I apologize that we don't have printed versions, obviously, for everybody at this point, but everybody has to use their electronic means in order to access the information. So if I can ask Mr. Chessis to begin, we will have you get started with that. Mr. Chessis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, so Article 1 pertains to would eliminate the licensing and bonding requirements for wholesale produce purchasers. Essentially, this was put in place to provide financial protection to sellers of perishable agricultural products if, say, a buyer were to renege on the purchase before the product, before they could find another buyer and the product spoiled. However, this hasn't been a widely used program for a number of reasons. One is that many agreements to purchase these perishable goods are made verbally, and as a result of that, the documentation necessary to support a claim against, say, a purchaser's bond is generally not there. There's also was concern from our stakeholders that strictly enforcing these licensing requirements could potentially create a disincentive for purchasing Minnesota goods. An advisory group that included representation from fresh fruit and vegetable growers, grocers, dairy, poultry, came to the opinion that really the cost of implementing the bonding and licensing requirements was greater than the actual benefits it provided. So this language would, again, eliminate the licensing and bonding requirements for the wholesale produce purchasers, but it retains the authority of the USDA to issue grade for produce transactions. And it would also retain the process that places producers ahead of other lenders for payment in the event of, say, some financial shortfall. So there are still some protections for producers that would remain, but it would just eliminate this license and bonding requirement that is not not supported really by the industry itself. I know the Minnesota Grocers Association is supportive of this, as well as other representatives from again poultry and dairy and other type of perishable product organizations. And that's really the that's a very brief overview of it, and I am happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chassis. We do have a question. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is, because we're talking about perishable agricultural farm products, what happens to the floral industry in this? You know, that's a very high-value specialty crop, and I'm concerned about the changing of the definition of perishable agriculture to perishable farm, and does this have any impact on the large producers that we have of flour products, floral products?
Mr. Chaffetz.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Cleavorn. Florists are not included in this language. They would, this does not cover them. In terms of protection specifically for florists,
I'm not talking about florists. I'm talking about growers, the farmers that grow our floral product, not the retailers.
Even the growers would not be covered by this. And I can ask and get back to you, Representative Cleavorn, as to what they might be covered under. I believe, I can follow up with you on that.
Okay, I just want to make sure that when we're redefining, thank you, Madam Chair, when we are looking at defining perishable farm products or perishable agricultural products, I want to make sure that that definition doesn't have a collateral effect someplace else. So if you could get me clarification on that. And then I would like to know where protections would be for our producers of those high-value floral specialty crops in the time of concern over perishable products. All right?
Mr. Chassis, we will be, bringing this DE before us on Thursday, so provide that information to Representative Cleavorn, but you can be prepared to provide it to the entire committee. So if you get an answer, we'll be able to pass that along to the entire committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there other questions regarding Article 1? Okay, I haven't seen anybody come through that wants to be recognized. So we're then going to move on. So we'll have Mr. Sullivan go through the balance of what is at this point the nearly completely agreed to DE with the Senate, but we, like I said, we may have some changes to it before we actually vote on it on Thursday, but we want to be able to have the run through today. So if Mr. Sullivan could go ahead and begin discussing, and this is House File 4285 DE. Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and members, this is Colby Sullivan from the House Research Department. Working from the DE1 that was sent out this morning in the top left, the time and date stamp is today at 8:18 a.m., and there's House Research in the middle of the header. The DE1 amendment that the chair is proposing has four articles. Article 1, perishable farm products, is the language that the Department of Agriculture has proposed in its supplemental finance bill, and would now be included in the omnibus ag policy bill. And Mr. Chess has described the language. I will highlight a couple of provisions when I walk through Article 1, but just to give a lay of the land, Article 2 is seed law language. That was also proposed by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the chair in the ag policy bill that the division heard earlier this session. Article 3 is also from that same bill, and it's language that members have heard previously this session and has to do with changes the Department of Agriculture has proposed to noxious weed and, noxious weed law. And Article 4, finally, is a miscellaneous article. There are a number of changes in that article, so I intend to spend a little more time on that article and to move through the first three articles fairly quickly unless members have questions. So starting on page 1, again, it's the perishable farm products language. I'll just note Section 2 begins at the bottom of page 1 and carries on to page 2. There was some discussion about the applicability of this these protections to different producers of different products. So just to see, under current law, produce is defined a bit more generally than maybe people would commonly think of leafy greens or something like that. Under current law, these protections apply to sellers, fresh fruits and vegetables, milk and cream products, poultry and poultry products, and the definition would be expanded in this bill a bit more to include sellers of mushrooms and eggs. And then one other note is on page 2, the definition of due date would be modified. And this due date effectively says that under current law, if a payment date is not specified in the contract between the seller and the buyer, the payment must be made generally within 10 days of delivery. The language here on line 2.8 and in other places in this article would extend that due date to 30 days after delivery. And then there are I'll skip over a number of the sections in this article and skip to the end, section 21, the final section in this article, and that is on page 13. And this is the repealer, and these are the sections that Mr. Chess mentioned that currently require a license for wholesale produce dealers and surety bond requirements for those same purchasers. Those would be eliminated in the repealer in section 21. Then on page 13 begins Article 2, feed law, the provisions that the committee heard earlier this year in the chair's policy bill. These were again recommended by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. There, in working with the department, putting together the DE, a couple of technical changes came to the chair's attention, and those technical changes are incorporated in this article. I will skip over those because they are, I think, relatively technical, unless members would like me to point them out. I guess I will point out Section 16 of Article 2, and that's on page 20 of the DE1 amendment. Section 16 is new. In working on the fiscal impact of this bill, and particularly the impact to the Ag Fund in the seed law article, the Department of Agriculture notified the chair that an additional section was needed in this article, and that's Section 16. and it was needed in order to effectuate the department's proposal regarding the seed permit fees that are paid by labelers of native grasses and wildflower seeds. So that's Section 16, which is new, again. Then moving on to Article 3, which begins on page 23 of the DE1 amendment. This was language proposed by the department regarding state noxious weed law. And this language, I believe, is exactly the same. There were no changes, no additions, no subtractions, no technical edits to Article 3. So I will move on to Article 4. And if members have questions, I could address those at the end. So Article 4 begins on page 31 and goes through the rest of the bill. There are roughly 40 sections in this article, some that were proposed originally by the Department of Agriculture and others that are legislator initiatives, including Section 1, which begins on 31.14. This is part of Representative Vang's industrial hemp bill, House File 3706. This first section, section number one, has to do with a cross-reference in the Government Data Practices Act, the Department of Agriculture's classification of certain data that hemp licensees and licensed applicants submit to the department. So this was in Representative Vang's bill, as heard by the committee earlier this session. Section two, beginning on 31.19, is from Representative Lippert's House File 3558. This has to do with recommendations from the Emerging Farmer Work Group that the department can this last year. And what this section does is it encourages the Department of Agriculture to provide advance payment of grants to certain farmers. And this is language that members heard earlier this year, and it has not been changed in this DE. You can see in clauses 1 through 3 the different classes of farmer who would receive this, who may receive advance payment of up to 50% of the grant award that the department would normally award to that recipient. And moving on to page 32, this is also from Representative Lippert's bill. This is the Emerging Farmer Work Group that the department would convene periodically to advise the agency. And this is language that's exactly the same as in Representative Lippert's bill, including the expiration date on 32.12 of August 1st, 2025. Section 4 has to do with the Agriculture Best Management Practices Loan Program. This was in House File 4285 as introduced, but it's been modified a bit in this DE amendment. As proposed initially in the bill as introduced, the program would be modified so that it would be available to urban landowners as well. Under current law, the Ag BMP program is available to farmers, agriculture supply businesses, and rural landowners. And initially, the bill proposed to eliminate that rural modifier, thereby opening up the program to urban landowners as well. But those changes were removed in the DE. So it's our understanding that if the DE were to be adopted, the program would still be limited to rural landowners. There are other changes the department recommended. I believe when Mr. Chesis presented the department's policy bill initially, he said that these are sort of changes to help align the program with how it's currently operated and to allow it to operate more efficiently. With that, there's another section, section 5 on page 34. That's also Ag BMP program and is the same as in the bill as introduced. No changes there. Same with section 6 on page 34. So then moving on to page 35, this is Farm Safety Grant and Outreach Programs. This is really a combination of several bills that the committee heard this year. House File 3224, Representative Brand's Farm Safety Bill. House File 3762, Representative Anderson's Farm Safety Bill, and House File 4538, the Chair Poppe's Supplemental Agriculture Finance Bill. So this is similar also then to the proposal that Mr. Chesis walked through at the beginning of the meeting to basically reinstate the expired tractor rollover protection grant program. That's subdivision one. Subdivision two is to create the new cost share program for grain storage facility safety equipment. You see that the grants per farmer would be limited on line 35.27 to $500 per bin or silo. That's from Representative Anderson's bill. And then the eligible equipment list that begins on the bottom of page 35 and continues on to page 36 is intended to be a combination of the different equipment specified as eligible in the bills that I mentioned earlier. So the intent is to be inclusive of all the different equipment that members had proposed to be eligible for these new grain storage facility safety grants. On 36.5, you see there's also language in here that is recommended by the Department of Agriculture in the Supplemental Ag Finance Bill to authorize the department to create a farm safety outreach campaign. And then on 36.8, there's authorization for the Department of Agriculture to use up to 6% of total program dollars each year for promotion and administration of this safety grant and outreach program. So then move on to Section 9, which is on page 37. This begins a series of sections from Representative Banks, House File 3706, in dealing with industrial hemp. I will highlight the changes that were made since the committee heard the bill and it was re-referred to the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee. And those changes are on, skipping forward to page 39. So there was language in the bill when it was first heard by the committee regarding the classification, data practices, treatment of data submitted by applicants for industrial hemp growth or processing to the department. That language has been modified after consultation with the Civil Law and Judiciary Committee. The language 39.12 to 39.14, that clause 2, I think it's similar in effect to the language this committee heard earlier this year, but maybe a bit more detailed in what type of information would be classified as private or non-public. And there was a change too to on 39.16 to 39.18, the circumstances in which the department could disclose that private or non-public data. And it was maybe tightened up is a way to put it. Now the department could release that information if only if there's a substantive threat to human health or safety or the environment or to aid in the law enforcement process. And then Section 18, which follows, this is brand new, also a result of the hearing in the Civil Law and Judiciary Committee. And this requires the department to establish written procedures to control access to this data that hemp licensees and applicants submit. It requires the department to log all queries and all agency responses for that data. And then paragraph B, which begins on 39.30, requires the department to immediately revoke the authorization of anyone who improperly accessed or shared the data. And by, let's see, and then on to page 40.3, finally paragraph C. This would require the department to submit a copy of this audit, data audit trail, as it's referred to, this log of who requested the information, who released it, who's accessed it. Every odd-numbered year, the department would have to provide that information to the entities that are listed beginning on 40.4. So there'd be the Commissioner of Administration, certain legislators, and the Joint Legislative Commission on Data Practices and Personal Data Privacy. And on Section 19, which begins on 40.8, this was modified a bit as well. The 40.110, the addition of processing to the department's rulemaking charge, that the committee has already seen that, but the new sentence beginning on 40.11, it's everyone's understanding that under current law, agencies have, I think it's I'm forgetting, maybe 18 months, 2 years from the date that rulemaking is authorized to get those rules finalized and implemented. And I understand the clock is ticking on the department's hemp rulemaking, in large part because of USDA action in the meantime. So what this section does is says the department's authority to adopt these rules would not expire as provided under current law generally, but would instead expire on June 30th of 2022. But then I will skip over language.
Madam Chair, this is Representative Hamilton.
Yes, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Sullivan, does that only apply to the rulemaking pertaining to hemp? As far as that authority to adopt these rules, the expiration date going out to June 30th of 2022.
Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, I believe that the way the language is drafted, it would be limited to the hemp rulemaking in that the language modifies the Industrial Hemp Development Act and refers to these rules, which I think in that context would limit that authority to hemp rulemaking.
Representative Hamilton.
Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Sullivan.
Okay, then members, I'll skip over the following sections, which the committee has already heard. They have to do with pet food regulations and custom processing of meat and poultry, egg temperatures. Let's see, so then we get to section 27, which is on the bottom of page 43. This is language that was in Representative Lippert's House File 3558, and it was also in Chair Poppe's Supplemental Agriculture Finance Bill that Mr. Chesset described, House File 4538, and it basically doubles the accumulative loan principle for recipients of the RFA's Pilot Agricultural Microloan Program loans. So that change is on 43.32. And then next begins on page 44. Section 28 begins a series of sections from Chair Poppe's House File 3799. These are changes requested by the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council, or MAILC, changing the membership of the board and then changing the word agriculture to agricultural in several places. So that continues through page 46, page 47, page 48. To the bottom of page 48, we come to section 32, the definition of grain. This is for purposes of grain buyer licensing at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And these sections were in Chair Poppe's bill that the committee heard earlier this year, House File 3991. Again, those are sections 32, section 33, and section 34. Then section 35 is from Chair Poppe's House File 1530. I believe the committee heard this bill last year, and it provides immunity for licensed veterinarians acting in good faith when they report suspected incidents of animal cruelty or when they put down an animal that, in their judgment, has been mistreated to the point that it cannot humanely be saved. That's section 35, and move on to page 50, section 36. This is new language to the division. This is from Representative Keel's House File 4328, and this has to do with a $5 million agri allocation for a soy innovation campus in Crookston. So this is what this section does, is it modifies an appropriation that was enacted last year, and the change is on 53.17. See, that's the $5 million carve out, if you will, from Agri for the innovative soybean processing and research. There'd be a change to remove soybean and add at the Ag Innovation Campus. I understand there may be additional changes that are being requested by the stakeholders to this language. So, but this is the language that was introduced in Representative Keel's bill and is included here in the DE. So then the final two sections are on page 54. The farm safety recommendation, section 37, this is from Representative Eklund's House File 4072. Members will remember, I believe it was in committee, that an amendment, a DE amendment, was adopted to convert the language in the bill to a set of recommendations to be brought back to the legislature next year in 2021. So that language appears here on page 54. And then the final section, section 38, is new. It's a biofuels report that the Commissioner of Agriculture would prepare and submit to the legislature on the same date, January 15th of next year. It's new language, but it's similar in concept to the bill members heard earlier this session, Chair Poppe's House File 3699, concerning biofuels. And this would require the department to provide more information about policies and infrastructure that would be needed to help the state meet its existing laws specifying the replacement of petroleum and the reduction of greenhouse gases. So that, Madam Chair and members, is the end of the DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. And I'm just going to turn it over to Mr. Savory for a comment. This bill is actually going to go to Ways and Means. And so, Mr. Savory, if you would address that, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Ken Savory, House Fiscal Analysis Department. I believe Ms. Connolly sent members of the committee a spreadsheet earlier this morning, and I'll be speaking to that particular document. And it says Minnesota House Fiscal Analysis Department at the top in large print, and has my name and department at the bottom left-hand corner. So I'll be speaking to that document just kind of briefly. Mr. Sullivan and Mr. Chesif went over a lot of the details of the two items I'm going to talk about, so I'll kind of skip those, but just wanted to bring to members' attention, if you're looking at the spreadsheet on line 7, Mr. Chesif went into details around removing the licensing requirement for wholesale produce dealers. That does create a fiscal impact for the agricultural fund. It's a negative, the revenue loss of $140,000 starting the fiscal year 21, and then that revenue loss repeats again in fiscal 22 and 23 for a total of $280,000 of revenue loss in the tails. Additionally, on line 8 of the spreadsheet, you'll see seed fee changes, which Mr. Sullivan went into detail on. Just a little sidebar on that. Currently, the native seed companies pay fees based on revenue from seed sales, and the new language that Mr. Sullivan described would change the fee structure to the pound seed sold, so it would change it to a type C permit. And because of that, there would be a negative $30,000 revenue loss impact to the agricultural fund starting in fiscal year 21 and then carrying forward into fiscal 22 and 23. So the fiscal impact of the DE amendment as currently constructed is $170,000 of revenue loss for the agricultural fund in fiscal 20 and 21, and then the same amounts in fiscal 22 and 23, so a total tails loss to the agricultural fund of negative $340,000. Both of these components were part of the governor's initial request, the wholesale produce dealer being in the governor's supplemental budget recommendations from March 12th, and then the CC item being the MDA policy bill as discussed earlier. And that concludes what I had to say on that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. So now we'll open it up for questions. Just a reminder that we're not voting this bill out today, but we are seeking public testimony by written form. So if you want to provide any written testimony, you can do that and submit to Ms. Connolly by noon tomorrow. And if you have amendments to this DE amendment, those will be due to Ms. Connolly by 5 p.m. tomorrow. But we do have time if people have questions. I know we have Commissioner Peterson and Board of Animal Health Executive Director Dr. Thompson on the line. So we want to be able to get to them and give them time to be able to discuss what's happening in animal agriculture. But we will have time. So I don't have anybody that sought recognition according to the according to Carl, but is there anyone that wants to seek recognition?
Madam Chair, yes, Representative Anderson has a question.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
This goes back to early in the presentation from Peter. Could he just explain to me, if he's still on the line, how a producer could get in front of a lender if the lender indeed has a first position on a mortgage?
Mr. Chesed?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, are you referring to the wholesale produce changes, or I'm sorry, which?
That's the one where you made that. Thanks, Madam Chair. Yeah, early on you talked about some additional protections for the producers, including being in front of lenders, and I'm just wondering how that could occur if the lender has a first position on a mortgage.
Mr. Chesed.
Yes, I believe that the changes we made or proposing to be made to Chapter 27 still retains the process that does place the producers ahead of the lenders under Chapter 27 in the event that there is a need to pursue non-payment type situation. So that authority would still be in place in spite of the changes that we're making to the bonding and licensing requirements.
Representative Anderson.
Okay, yeah, that answers my question. I'm still not quite sure I agree with it, but that's good for now. Thank you.
Any other questions? Anybody else seeking to be recognized? All right. I don't hear anybody. I don't see anybody. So I'm going to just, we will move on from this point. We're going to move into a COVID-19 update. Certainly, Commissioner Peterson and the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health, Dr. Thompson, have been working 24/7 in the last number of weeks to address a lot of animal agriculture issues. And so I want to make sure we wanted to have them come before us, but we also didn't want to take up too much of their time since they've been really involved with our farmers and producers and processors to deal with these issues. So it seemed appropriate today, since they could be with us, to be able to give them the opportunity to hear from them. And so what I think we'll do is we'll have if you don't mind, Commissioner, if you're online, we'd have you get started, and then we'll hold off questions for the most part until both Commissioner Peterson and Dr. Thompson are able to address us. So welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Thank you for everything that you've done, and thank you to your staff for doing what they're doing, and congratulations that you are now officially the Commissioner of Agriculture in Minnesota. We're very thankful to have you. So welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And again, my name is Tom Peterson, and I'm Commissioner of Agriculture officially. And great to visit with you today from our rainy home and farm in Pine City. You know, just an amazingly tough time, unprecedented for our farmers right now. You know, you've all seen the Smithfield news was the first thing really to hit, you know, and a good portion of our hogs go to that Smithfield plant. And so having that go down was a tough issue. Then having a JBS plant go down, another big portion of our hogs, it's almost 50% of our hogs in the state, needed to find a new home. So some of those hogs are going to other plants. But other plants have closed down in Iowa and upper Midwest. Good news is our Hormel plant is running good in the Shears district, and they're running on Saturdays and taking extra hogs. Our prime pork plant in Windham had been down for a week. I talked with them again this morning. They started back up Friday and are running very strong. In fact, they hope to also run on Saturdays and be able to take extra hogs off the market. And so that's a big issue. We also, about 10 days ago, had to depopulate chickens across the state, and that has to do with eggs. And that was more of a packaging issue at that point. Eating home 80% of the time instead of eating out 50% of the time really changed up the need and the packaging. And so we did have to depopulate several chicken farms as well in Minnesota and are continuing to do that. You probably also saw the news of Genio and Wilmer going down with two plants. And then last night having to shutter their Melrose plant. That's about 70,000 birds. That is also going to create a big issue. There's nowhere for those birds to go. And so that is the issue as we look at depopulation. But also Dr. Thompson can talk about this and our plans for that, and we can kind of fill in some of the things we're doing as the Department of Agriculture. I just want to remind people that we get a lot of questions about, can we send these pigs to the local plants, and can we do that? Before this happened, not long before we got into this, your committee actually had a hearing about meat processing on the local level. Just want you to know we're doing everything we can. But one of the side effects of this COVID-19 is people are buying directly from the farmer at record numbers. And so those plants that were already taxed at the local level are seeing increased business just from our farmers at direct market. The farmers that I buy from in my area are selling anywhere to 4 to 5 times what they normally sell. So that's a good thing, but very difficult. So what we've been doing, we work with any of our custom plants in Minnesota. There's a lot of them that want to move to USDA, and we can move our two equal two. And we've been doing that and moving as many plants that want to. We have been working with them. We have a quick turnaround on that. We are working with any butchers and things that want to work and move into that position. And so I really appreciate our staff. We used our agri funds. We did 9 grants about 2 weeks ago on bigger scale projects to help bring some of those plants forward. We also just announced a mini grant yesterday for plants. One of the problems with all this local processing is storage. And so this will help that and alleviate that as well. We also have 2 staff people that, again, this is on our COVID page, that are really working and triaging and helping farmers find homes for, if they can't sell their livestock. They mostly can help on a smaller scale, but we have, people calling and saying, we have Louisiana pork producers, for example, will take semi-loads of pigs. We have Amish that'll take loads of pigs. We're coordinating a lot of that, too, as well. We're trying to work on food donations. Again, the problem is just processing. And so I just want to highlight how difficult this is for farmers. We do have our RFA zero interest loan. We'll be making our first loans, I understand, this week. And want to keep reminding people that that is out there as well. We're working closely with our federal partners. I appreciate all the help, Representative Hamilton, and the ideas he has. We are looking at our emergency preparedness account that has $577,000 in it. Keep in mind that sounds like a lot of money, but it really isn't. And so we're working with the associations to figure what is the best use of those dollars. Those dollars were to be used for African swine fever, avian influenza, which hopefully, knock on wood, we don't have those appear. But right now, this is an emergency. This is critical, and we're prepared to use those, and we have some good ideas on what to do with that money. And I just want to also highlight that as well. So glad to take any questions and appreciate the partnership we have with Dr. Thompson. And with that, I can just stop, and I'll be glad to stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think we'll just turn to Dr. Thompson now so she can also have the opportunity to present everything that she's been dealing with, and welcome to the committee, Dr. Thompson. Thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you, Chair Poppe, members of the committee, Beth Thompson, State Veterinarian and Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. As I'm familiar with a lot of you, I usually start out a presentation by talking about how the board is the state agency that has oversight on animal disease. But as the commissioner just talked about, this is not a disease situation. COVID-19 has caused the breakdown of our production practices, you know, specifically how our meat and poultry is being processed. And there was a lot of good information that Commissioner Peterson talked about. I mean, we're talking about the plants that are here in Minnesota that take many of our hogs and now poultry. We're talking about plants in our neighboring states, the Smithfield plant over in Sioux Falls. And I just want everybody to be aware, and unless states are out there, we don't know when these plants are going to be stood up again. And most recently, there's another Smithfield plant in North Carolina. As of yesterday, I got a little bit of information, first of all, that they shut down completely, and that plant actually handles about 7% of U.S. production. And then I got information that they might be standing up a small crew so that it can continue with some production. But I think rather than going over, and again, I appreciate working with Commissioner Peterson and the Department of Ag, but rather than going through everything that he's already touched on, I want to leave just one number with you. We have some very smart veterinarians in the state of Minnesota, and I'm very thankful every day, especially in situations like this, that I have those contacts and those people are working on the health of our animals here in the state. But a group of swine veterinarians early on, about 2 weeks ago, put together a spreadsheet, and this is specifically hogs. So the spreadsheet looks at a best case scenario for getting animals euthanized or processed or depopulated. As these plants are either going down or coming back online. So what I'm going to give you is the best case scenario as of yesterday, and that is all the current plants that are shut down would be back open on May 18th and back up to 75% production on June 1st. Let me say that again. All the current plants that are shut down would be back open on May 18th and at 75% production by June 1st. And this does take into account the plant that just shut down in North Carolina. So, you know, working through the week starting April 13th, there was a shortfall in our processing ability of almost 300,000 hogs. As we work through those weeks, each week we continue to get more and more of a backlog. If we work to the week of June 8th, we will have a backlog of 4.3 million hogs across the United States. And again, that's the best case scenario, everyone. So with that, Chair Poppy, I'll step back for any questions. And again, thank you to all of you, the folks that have reached out to us. Our staff are working hard, and really my heart is going out to hog producers and other livestock producers in the state of Minnesota right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Thompson. Definitely sobering statistics there, sobering numbers. I know that we have people who would like to ask questions, and I'll start with Representative Keel. Representative Keel, we can't hear you at this point.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Okay, Representative Keel.
Sorry about that. Yes, we've heard about hogs, and I understand the challenges there. But I've been approached by, and chickens too, I've been approached by beef farmers, cattlemen, that are having some real challenges. Is that the challenges mostly federal, or are they growing in the state? I know that isn't one of our larger animal populations, but.
Commissioner Peterson?
Sure. So for beef, right now, our processing in our state is not a challenge. We don't have a lot, but some of the other ones in our area have closed down, such as Green Bay, and just as my understanding. And so that is the issue. The good news is for cattle, we can hold them longer. pigs mm-hmm. and turkeys, chickens, we have about a month, you know, on when they reach their stage, and we just can't slow them down enough. Cattle we can turn out on pastures, and we can just keep them on farms longer. Some of the problems is there's a backup in beef. One of the issues is, in talking to some of our bigger packers, is storage. They run to capacity every day, and they need to store their product. And that's good news, because that means, you know, we're trying to just set a call with the grocers that there is product out there. It's just a question of moving it around. So we're watching the beef piece very carefully. Earlier we had a panic on hamburger when we had cull cows, dairy going to be culled, and we had several livestock auctions in Minnesota cancel their sales for the week. Those are back up and running, you know, and again, the price isn't good, but at least the beef situation for now is holding steady. But excellent question, and I don't know if Dr. Thompson has anything to add.
Dr. Thompson?
No, I have nothing further. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next, we'll go to Representative Bang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, if it seems like the plant's going to open again in a couple of weeks, I'm curious to know what are some worker safety protocols that you guys are establishing or implementing to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Thank you. We need the workers in the plants. You know, the plants don't run without the workers, and that's one of the issues that we have been seeing. And I want to be clear, too, the companies are learning from this. They're learning from each other. They're doing everything they can. You know, talking with Jenny O, you know, some of these plants are going down out of concern for their employees. You know, as they see the issues developing, they're changing their locker rooms, their cafeterias, their common areas, how they pass in the hallways. Our administration put out a guidance that there are 20 larger processing plants in the state will be following, and most of them have told us that they can do this. They're making changes as we go. And so that has been very positive. We also are working on some of our bigger food companies, again, where we have people working in close proximity. This is not just limited to livestock. We are also starting to see it in other food packaging companies as well, and will in the coming days. So the guidance that we put out is on our website, and I can try to share that with the committee later. Thank you.
Representative Bang, did you have any other questions?
No. Thank you, Commissioner. I would just like to be kept in touch about, you know, how those guidelines being implemented and enforced.
And next we have Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have three questions, and I will just I'll give you all three questions, and then I'll just be quiet and let you answer. The first question I have is, these are healthy animals that we're talking about. So we know that this is not happening as a result of the farmers. It really is a disease that was spread in the plant among the workers, not the animals. So my question is, because of that, are the major processors insured against this loss to help us with some of the recovery process? And then with our large producers, is there any coverage for them? I'm trying to get my head around the fact about these purchase agreements. So were the processors the owners of these animals, or were the animals still in the ownership of our large producers? So I'm trying to figure out where the loss is truly going to fall. Is it on the hands of the producers, or is it on the hands of the plants, so our processors? And then my last question really is to the very point that Representative Bang just asked. You know, when we are talking about a loss of healthy animals because of protocols that were in place in plants, then what are the requirements that we're going to have going forward? You know, I feel like in some instances here, there are more protections against swine flu than there were protections for our workers in the plants. And I just want to make sure that all of our industries are always worker-focused in safety. And this public health crisis is a safety issue. So I just want to make sure that we are protecting our workers. And then I'll just listen to your response. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner.
We're still working through what the plants and their indemnity is on this, and so I don't have a good answer for that. That would have to come from, asking the companies that, or maybe having them testify. We are working with the federal government too on the payments for this. Would right now come through the NRCS from the federal government for the farmers or the farms. It's really a mix of the animals and the contracts on who owns the hogs or the chickens. We have both independents and we have both contracted pigs, and so the liability and the damage is on both. So in some cases, the chickens for one of the companies would come out and pay and take care of everything. On the hogs, it could be a mix of both. But in most cases, the farmer is on the hook for the beginning of getting this done. And so it's kind of a mix that we're working through as we go forward, and there's a lot of moving parts on that. Representative Hamilton may be able to shed some more light on the numbers on that. But right now, it's kind of a mix. And then on the requirements on the workers, I just reiterate, like, what we're doing. We work as a partnership with the Department of Health, Department of Labor and Industry, and to ensure those workers' safety in the plants. And again, this virus, we're learning things about it all the time. And so our plants ran very well for the first few weeks of this virus, but as it spread, I think we're learning, whether it was community transmission or if it was actually spreading in the plant. A lot of the plants felt like it was coming from community transmission, but I think we learned that it was really the close contact. And so there's a lot that we're learning every day. And again, plants don't run without people. One of the things is to get these plants up and running. We want them to keep up and running. We don't want to start, have another outbreak, and go down again. I use the Wyndham plant right now as a good model. They went down last Monday, did a deep cleaning. We came in, tested all their employees. The healthy employees went back to work Friday. They ran well Friday, Saturday, Monday, and are running good today. So that's all I have.
Thank you. Next, we have Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this is kind of a question for both Commissioner Peterson and Dr. Thompson. That information that you put together on some estimates on backup on processing, has that been shared formally with USDA? And if yes, what was their reaction? Are they making similar projections?
How about Dr. Thompson?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Lewick, I have shared this quite widely, specifically within USDA. I can't speak to which people have gotten it, but I continue to push this out as far as getting it out to other states also, because it's not just a Minnesota problem. But yes, we have, and I have not heard anything formally on a big picture plan back from USDA, and that's part of the frustration. Thank you.
Just a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Sure.
Yes, I would certainly be interested in seeing that information in a manner that would be useful to provide to some of our legislative leaders back in Washington, D.C., because I did have a discussion Friday morning with a couple of our federal representatives, and I'm not sure they fully grasp where we're at, but But, yeah, anything you could provide would be great. Appreciate it. Now, move on very quickly to another question, probably, probably Commissioner Peterson. It's just my sense that USDA is not quite fully in the game on this. FSA obviously has the capacity to provide some direct aid for losses and other programs. I believe AVIS has sort of came online with a kind of an emergency management approach. But are we really getting a bang for the buck from USDA? Do they grasp this issue and how deeply it's really going to be a train wreck for us if we don't get this thing back in the box?
Yeah,
and thank you, Representative and Madam Chair and Representative Lewick. And it's a great question. And we had a call this morning with all the congressional delegations, myself and the governor. And I think that they're working together, at least our delegation, and really putting a lot of pressure on the USDA to continue to deliver, not just through APHIS and the NRCS, but we're going to need a lot of resources. Iowa just submitted a plan that I think calls for assistance of $35 million per week to help the hog industry just in Iowa. And keep in mind, this is all the 15 large hog-producing states where we're number two. But Illinois, Indiana, Nebraska, South Dakota, they're burying hogs today. This is, it's a monumental problem. And so we are, pushing the USDA for more and more resources and dollars. And so you're very, that's a very excellent point. But I also just want you to know that we're coordinating with our congressional delegation, and they're being very helpful.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Dr. Thompson. That's all I had for right now.
Thank you. Next, we have Representative Kapke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Dr. Thompson, and there have been a few reports about COVID making the jump to different animal populations, mainly cats at this point, that I have read. And I was just going to see if you have any information and understanding as to if there's any research being done around other particularly livestock populations that we have here in Minnesota that we need to be aware of or be thinking about in the future if that were to make the jump to other animal populations.
Dr. Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Tapke. Good question. Yes, those reports of, and most people probably heard about the tiger in the Bronx Zoo. And we've also had reports of especially felines, cats, a couple of dogs from Asia. I don't have the reports in front of me right now, but it's my understanding of the research that COVID-19 does not affect livestock species and that it has a slight predilection for cats and ferrets, and even dogs. It doesn't look like dogs would be affected by the virus. And then I need to be very clear about this. It looks like there is a transmission route from human to animals, and again, that's just cats and ferrets, but there is no transmission noted back to humans. So, usually in these cases, you have a sick person in the house, they're shedding a lot of virus. Somehow the cats, and whether or not there have been ferrets reported, I'm not sure, but the cats are picking up the virus. So, again, it looks like cats and ferrets may pick up the virus, but there is no evidence whatsoever that it would transmit back to humans. We've worked very closely with the Department of Health. We're taking those questions from our veterinarians here in Minnesota about those possible issues. And we've got a directive that's, or a fact sheet that's on our website if you're interested. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. And maybe you addressed this. I had to hop off the meeting for a moment to take another call. But with the crisis we're in, and I understand, a triage and trying to deal with the massive imminent challenge relating to dealing with the livestock. What's kind of the long-term goal here after the massive public investment that occurs. Do you see, is our goal here to get back to where we were before this happened, or is there, you know, usually with crises, there are transformative events that lead to changes in the model, the different models of how we actually do things, because reality shifts very quickly. So separate from the immediate, let's say, acute crisis, where do you see us maybe 5 years from now? And I just want to preface this, that there are tons of businesses that are going to be failing that do not have the, shall we say, clout that agriculture has been able and are not able to get direct cash assistance to help them survive. They are going to go down. They're in my district. They're in every district in this state and in this country. So if we are going to do a massive public support, which I believe we will need to do, what does this all look like at the end of the day?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, thank you for that question. And, you know, it's hard to look at the big picture right now, is and I wish I could, as we kind of triage everything that we're doing, as you said, and that's a very accurate description, because every minute of the day, and as, even as we're talking here, I feel like things are being thrown at me that I've never contemplated, and it can be overwhelming. But at the same time, as I mentioned, I think that we're learning things. Diversity has always been something that having more markets, but that's not as easy as it said. I think, as I said, we had already started to look at one of the initiatives I've tried to do as commissioner was to build out our processing, was to really use our value-added grants to use and build our capacity around the state. That's why we try to bring in crops like hemp and things to try to really diversify our economy at all scales for agriculture. And so that's what I think on the other side of COVID-19, our food system will look different, both at the small scale and the large scale. And so we have to continue to look at that. And I hope as things start to slow down and we get a handle on things, we'll continue to do that and look as we come out of this. And so I appreciate that. I also want to say that, you know, we're going to lose farms. You know, we're losing. There's just no way out of that. You all know on this committee that we've had 5 years of down prices. We had farmers taking their lives and going out of business before this happened. And so to have this on top of everything is extremely important, that the work that you're doing, extending the mediation, considering help for foreclosures, support for our farm advocates. Our farm advocates, you know, right now I send people to them almost on a daily basis, and having that service free of charge for our farmers is important and it's helpful. That maybe some of the small businesses, Representative Hansen, like you're saying, don't have, you know, and so you're right. We do have clout and we have resources because of a lot of the work that you legislators have provided us, including our mental health counseling. So excellent question, and I look forward to continuing to have time to contemplate that as we go forward. Thank you.
All right. I don't have anybody else on the list, but I just want to ask a question about, we do hear a lot about animal agriculture, and clearly that's a significant loss and very serious. But I wanted to just touch on ethanol, because I know that I've also heard about ethanol plants and the issues there. And so I just wanted, Commissioner, to have an opportunity to follow up in what's happening with the, corn growers and ethanol plants.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, the hits just keep coming, ethanol, as we got into kind of a oil battle before COVID-19 started and prices dropped, and then people just driving less has really further hit that market. And so we have had plants
shutter. We've had three plants that are just have temporarily laid off their employees or gone down for maintenance. We have, 14 that are running actively right now. A lot of them have cut their production. A lot of them are doing great things, whether it's producing alcohol for our hand sanitizer and working with that. That's really important. We also have talked about the importance of ethanol in our CO2 production. We use CO2 production for many things in our state. We rely on it as one of our top sources in Minnesota. We have five of our 17 ethanol plants in Minnesota produce CO2. That's also very important to our animal agriculture industry. Many of our large livestock processors use CO2 from ethanol plants in the euthanization process. So again, very difficult for them. We're working at the federal level for relief on that as well. And we continue to work on the Governor's Biofuel Council for recommendations for that as well, on that will be due probably in at the end of October.
Thank you. We have about 2 minutes left, so is there anyone else that wants to be recognized?
Madam Chair, I did send something in.
Representative Hamilton. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I have a couple comments. First, Commissioner, when this is all said and done and we do a postmortem, I would like to see a difference, if there's a difference at all, between U.S.-owned plants versus foreign-owned plants on how they've handled this crisis, all the way from employee safety through getting these plants up and running. Once it's all over, maybe there's nothing there, but it'd be interesting to see how the different entities address this whole thing. I'd also like to reiterate what Chair Poppe said. Commissioner, congratulations and thank you on everything you're doing. Commissioner, you and I have talked almost daily. You've been very responsive to all questions, comments, concerns. Personally, I believe you're doing a fantastic job. Same with Dr. Thompson. Same to you. I call you quite often as well. And just the response that I'm getting from both of you, and not only myself, but the industry as a whole, I can't thank you enough. You're doing a fantastic job. And I just want to, say thank you.
Appreciate that, Representative Hamilton. So any final questions?
Yeah, Madam Chair, this is Anderson,
yes.
Last comment.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with what has been said by Chair Hamilton, and thanks to the Commissioner and to Dr. Thompson. I don't mean to spring anything, but I just got an email from one of our wineries in Minnesota, and evidently, their demand is going down also. They're shut down. And Minnesota law limits them to two cases per year of direct shipments of wine to customers. They say neighboring states, Wisconsin, South Dakota, have 12 cases a year limits. North Dakota has a 36 case per year limit. Could we quickly do something to increase the number of cases of wine wineries could ship, at least in this situation here in Minnesota? Just going to throw that out to the committee for food for thought.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. I don't know if you have any comments on that, Commissioner.
I'm going to leave, Ms. Madam Chair. I'll leave that in the liquor lobby. I appreciate that, Representative Anderson. It's not something we have for view. We do promote those, but I know there's others that have strong feelings about that and why we ended up there, and having trying to work around that in my previous job a few times, it was somewhat difficult and trying to understand that. I just want to thank all the legislators, too, for, their ideas. And like I said, this is I take every great or crazy idea that people have right now, and I just appreciate that. So thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, members. Certainly thank you, Commissioner Peterson. Thank you, Dr. Thompson. And we would also want to know that the liquor bill is up in Commerce on Friday, so maybe that might include some possibility for the wineries. And Dr. Thompson received permission from the veterinarians regarding the spreadsheet, and that has been distributed by Ms. Conley. So we have nothing else before us today. Just a reminder, if you have amendments, they need to be in by 5 p.m. If you'd like to provide written testimony, you're listening in on this call, want to provide written testimony for the TV, that's due to Ms. Conley by tomorrow at noon. And so with nothing else before the committee right now, I'm going to call meeting adjourned.